Okay. All of the classes, all of the classes will be recorded. All of the materials have been PDF'd. And so if you miss the class or you have a friend who misses the class, do not be saddened. All you have to do is email. You can email me. My email address is on the bottom of every page of the source sheet. You can email the shul office, which most of you will have that information. It's in the binders. And you simply say, I missed the class on Radak. I heard it was unbelievable. The best class ever given in Boca Raton Synagogue history. Can't miss that one. Right? Everyone knows. FOMO. Right? Fear of missing out. No one wants to be subjected to FOMO. That might be beyond this crowd here tonight. But there's a concept called FOMO. You don't want to miss out when everyone's talking at the water cooler tomorrow about the Radak class the night before. And so all you have to do is email us. You'll get the PowerPoint. You'll get this. And you'll get the recording. And simply at your own leisure, in the comfort of your living room, probably with better air conditioning than we have here, you can listen to the recording. Those are all points of introduction. Last but not least, yashar koach to all of you for coming. Really, let's give ourselves a round of applause. There are so many things people can be doing on a Tuesday night, certainly a Tuesday night right before Thanksgiving, and I know what all of you are thinking. I have so much to do, I have family, the nor'easter, are they going to get on their plane, not going to, the turkey, right? Put it all out of your mind. You're here, you've dedicated time and resources to enjoy some learning every Tuesday night, and really just have fun with it, because hopefully it'll be a great experience, and I know I had a tremendously enjoyable time preparing the material, and I hope you in turn have a tremendously enjoyable time listening to my annoying sounding voice for the next hour and 18 minutes. Okay, before we officially get started, I want to offer a few thank yous to Matthew Hockerman, who's walking out of the room right now because he's going to get embarrassed, to Kerry from the shul office, to Amy, Jamie in the shul office. These binders don't happen on their own, the publicity doesn't happen, the sign-up sheets, none of this. Not only was I not helpful, I was unhelpful in all this. So it's really a testimony to all of them. To Theo, who sets up the room, and all the janitorial staff, I really appreciate, I'm sure they can hear me, I hope they can hear me, but we really can appreciate, and just to show you how much we appreciate it, not only did I say thank you in one language, but I tried to say thank you in as many languages that I thought possible, and that was just me with too much time on my hands today. So if the presentation stinks, it's because Moscow had spent all this time going on Google finding how to say thank you in all of these fakakta languages. Okay. Got a little Farsi here, Hebrew, French, Italian. We got it all. Okay. So, but I really do appreciate all of their efforts. Okay. Last thing, because Matthew just reminded me. Before you leave, I purposely did not give out the PowerPoints in advance because I don't want you cheating. But they're here for you at the end. So everyone on the end should take. They're kind of staggered. So if you're just intellectually honest, don't take more than one. But they have, again, three hole punches. You stick them in, and they're yours for keeping. And last, I've said that 10 times now, but I keep on remembering things. You each have a flyer on your table. Boca Raton Synagogue in 2 weeks is hosting a Women's Health and Halacha Day. Men, don't turn off your brains just yet, because you either have wives or know people who are of the female gender. And so please, please, please encourage people to come. The flyer's on the front. The schedule is on the back. It should really be an incredible day. The whole thing is free. Free food, free lunch. If you have children, there's babysitting for a nominal fee. So there's really, we've tried to rob people of any excuses not to come. And it should really be a fantastic day. So if it's not applicable to you, please share it with others, because it will really be a fantastic day. Okay. What I want to do before we start, who here remembers this? Okay, we saw this a few times, vaguely. Now, vaguely because it's a little bit blurry on here, but also because it's been what? It's been 7, 8 months, 9 months. 9 months since we last saw this at our last class that I gave. Okay, so I want to go through this very quickly, just to give us a baseline of what it is we're talking about when we talk about Jewish history, and specifically so that when I start talking about time periods tonight on a more nuanced level, you understand a little bit of the context. Okay, this is introductory in nature, but hopefully it'll help you, it'll remind you and help you understand the context of this class. Okay, let's start over here. We start with Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. Okay, the written Torah, of course, is the Bible, which takes place long before these dates ever happen. Okay, we have our five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And then we have the prophets. Okay, all in all, the canonized book of the Bible, which is the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim, is how many books? 24 books. Okay, that's all here. That is all what all of this is trying to understand. Okay, these 24 books, which are sometimes enigmatic, in the last 3,000 years of Jewish history, has all been trying to understand these 24 books. When we come to this period, that's where we started off last year. The Mishnah, the Tosefta, we come into the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli. Remember, there were two Talmuds. There was a Talmud that was written in Jerusalem, a Talmud that was written in Babylonia. You'll recall that the Talmud in Babylonia goes on much further than the Talmud that took place in Israel, primarily because the Jews in Israel were kicked out right in the middle here. And so the Talmud Yerushalmi is somewhat of an unfinished document. If you remember from last year, we described how the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, more than 50% of the Babylonian Talmud was added on by later editors. Okay, so much of what we learn contemporarily in the Babylonian Talmud is added on by editors to help us understand what in God's name the Talmud is talking about. Which is why it's so rare that people study Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, because without editing, it's very choppy, it's very hard to understand, it's very difficult, and therefore it's not as widely studied. Okay? When we come to this period, roughly speaking from the year 1000 to 1500, it's talking about the period of the Rishonim, the early commentaries. Now, some of these names should hopefully be familiar to you. You have the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam, who we spent two classes on last year talking about. You have Rashi. You have the Tosafists, all commentaries on the Talmud. You have the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, who you remember is a Spanish origin, one of the first Spanish personalities to condense the Talmud into a very reader-friendly type of work. Okay? That all takes us up to the period of the Shulchan Aruch, which was really, essentially, one of the major first attempts to codify Jewish law. Okay? What we are going to be talking about tonight is right in the beginning of this period, the period of the Rishonim. Now, you learned a lot about the Rishonim last week, so I'll just jog your memory for a little bit. You learned a little bit about the Ashkenazi Rishonim versus some of the Sephardi Rishonim. You learned about Rashi and Ibn Ezra. Now, what all of you are thinking right now is those terms are peripherally familiar to me, but I'm a little bit confused. So don't worry, we're going to do a little bit of background because it's going to be of critical importance to understanding our class tonight. That was somewhat done purposefully. But we're going to be talking in this general period right here. Okay? What the Rishonim are trying to do, as what everyone is trying to do throughout Jewish history, is respond to the previous generation's bodies of work. So for example, the Mishnah was written to try to understand the Torah. Well, the Mishnah was somewhat enigmatic. So the Talmud comes along and tries to understand the Mishnah. Well, the Talmud is somewhat enigmatic. And it kind of, I don't want to say loses relevancy, but somewhat needs to be updated to deal with contemporary issues. And so you have the Rishonim. Well, the Rishonim finish and the Achronim come along. Every generation is simply trying to understand the works of the previous generation. Now, I remind you of this again to show you that the Torah is not a dead text. The Torah is a very live text. What the commentaries throughout Jewish history are trying to do is continuously contemporize it, continuously make it relevant, to make it applicable, and to understand it within the new context and the new reality. Okay? And everything is in conversation with everything else. So whether we know it or not, but when we look at the Shulchan Aruch is not just a text out of the blue, but it's really a conversation with previous texts and contemporary texts, all trying to understand it and to make it as modern as possible. as contemporary, as relevant as possible. I'll just share with you one quick anecdote. I was previously in Israel just a couple weeks ago with the Jewish Federation. And we were sitting there on Friday night at the Kotel, and we had a little bit of time before we went back to the hotel for dinner. And I was speaking to someone who is completely unaffiliated, had never, barely knew he was Jewish up until this trip, had no consciousness of Jewish texts. And I was describing to him this exact chart, basically. I was describing to him how Torah literature is not dead, but it's very alive, and everything is, it's an intergenerational conversation between rabbis to try to make it as relevant as possible. And so what I did is, we were at the Kotel, I noticed a Talmud right behind us, and I opened up a Talmud and I showed him how Rashi is talking to Tosfot, and they're trying to understand the Talmud, and the commentaries in the back are trying to understand, everyone's trying to understand everyone else, and everyone's building upon everything else. Well, by the end of the conversation, the person was in tears, not because of what I was saying. But when you realize that the Torah is a very alive text, so it's a magnificent thing. It takes something that's a piece of paper, and it makes it something that's very relevant, something very alive. That's the whole beauty of this course. And that's what I just wanted to remind us of in viewing this chart that we have in front of us. The Radak, our person of the evening. Okay, who here has ever learned about the Radak by a show of hands? Okay. Who remembers anything they've learned about the Radak by a show of hands? All right, good. So we're working with a clean slate, and that's why we have a clean slate. The Radak lived in 1160 to 1235. Can someone name me one other major personality that lived around that time? Rambam. Hey, a couple people said Rashi. It's interesting. We miss Rashi by a generation, but that's going to be of critical importance, so I'm happy you made that mistake. The Rambam, the Radak was a contemporary of the Rambam, which means that he was involved in what controversy? The Maimonidean controversy. Okay, the Radak does take sides. We're not going to get into it as much this evening. The Radak is born in Narbonne, Provence, which we'll get to in just a second, a little bit more. He's the son of Rabbi Yosef Kimchi and the brother of Moshe Kimchi. Why do I tell you that? I don't tell you who his aunts and uncles are. Because the Radak builds upon the writings of his father and his brother oftentimes, both in actual practice, he'll quote them often, and in methodology, and I'll get back to all of this a little bit as we go on. Again, he was a contemporary of the Rambam, involved in the Maimonidean controversy. The Radak was the Rashi of Nach. Okay, the same way when you can't open up a Bible, you can't open up a Chumash, and understand what the Torah is trying to tell us without the commentary of Rashi. It's kind of like having your cake with no icing on it, it just loses a little bit of its flavor. When you come to learning Nevi'im and Ketuvim, okay, the other 19 books of Tanakh, you simply can't understand it without looking at the works of Radak. He is a major player. Anyone who comes to my selfless promotion right now of my Tuesday morning Haftorah class will know that I quote Radak, and I almost never quote Rashi. Not because I don't like Rashi, but Radak is really the person you're going to look to. We only have his commentary on Brachos in the Torah. We don't know why, but I'll give you a sense in a second, and that is that he was a major anti-Christian polemist. And that's where we're going to spend almost the bulk of our evening on tonight, is going through the Radak and his commentary, railing against Christianity in his commentary. You want me to speak louder? Now you're... I press buttons. That's my thing. You can't see the bottom because of this? Because of this. A little bit better? Okay, fine. Okay? And last but not least, the Radak was a big grammarian. Now again, we're going to get back to all this later. I just wanted you to have a little bit of a context to who he was. Now we spoke about that Radak was born in Provence. Provence is this little chunk of real estate right here in southeastern France. And the reason why I make such a big deal about that is if you look at our map here, where this is where he's born in Narbonne, so what do we know about him? What can you tell automatically? For those specifically who came last year?
Close to Spain.
It's close to Spain. It's very close to Spain. Okay, it's on the border, basically, of France and Spain. And so as you remember from our Ramban class from last year, which I'm sure you've all been reviewing all summer long, and you know it like you know your children's names, so you'll remember that there was a major tug of war, major differences in philosophies. between the France way of doing things, and again, I'm using these terms loosely, but the Ashkenazi way of doing things and the Sephardi way of doing things. And again, we're going to come back to all this, but I want you to keep this imagery, because I want you to realize just where the Radak is, that he's literally sitting at the melting pot of France and Spain, and we'll see that the Radak does have a little bit of an identity crisis, because part of him is Spanish in nature, his family comes from Spain, but he lives in France, and so part of him is French in nature. And that's going to create a real clash of ideology and methodology, and you can't understand the Radak without appreciating the context of this map. My goal in everything that I'm telling you tonight is not to make you PhD scholars in the Radak, because I'm not a PhD scholar in the Radak. I know what I read. I'm a very good article reader, and I can translate it into PowerPoints. Okay? What I want everyone to come away for tonight is that next time you read a commentary of the Radak, it's no longer like, oh, that's a nice thing to say. Thank you very much. It's no longer just a nice thing to say, but you understand it. It makes sense to you. So when you're going to look at the Radak and you're going to see certain elements of Spanish methodology, and you're going to see certain elements of French methodology, and again, I'm going to explain all this, so don't be afraid if you're not understanding what I'm saying, because probably no one does, but I want you to understand it, and we're going to read it into his text, and that's going to be the beauty of it, because we're going to bring the Radak to life tonight. That's the whole purpose. Okay. Historical overview. Just to give us a little bit of a, again, a little bit of a bearings historically what we're talking about. Okay? There were lots of crusades. Okay, 1096, the first crusade in Germany, 1147, the second crusade in France, 1188, the third crusade, more crusades going into the 13th and 14th century. Almost all of these crusades take place where? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize this. Okay, in Ashkenaz, which we'll call France, northern France, right, in Germany. Okay, what's taking place at the exact same time in Spain? Well, primarily it's the Golden Age of Spain. And so Spanish Jewry and French Jewry, forget, before we even get to the methodology, they're having very different interactions with the culture and society around them. If you're a Jew living in France during the medieval period, okay, do you like your neighbors or not like your neighbors?
Not.
You do not like your neighbors. Are you open to interactions with your neighbors or not open to interactions with your neighbors?
Not.
You're not open to interactions with neighbors, okay? Generally, and again, I'm speaking in broad strokes to paint a picture, there are always going to be exceptions. Generally speaking, Ashkenazi Jews, in other words, living in France and Germany, had very negative interactions with their Christian neighbors. Okay? There was a real animosity, there was a real reluctance to engage in any form of meaningful relationships and dialogue, because how did that usually end? Well, you see it right here, right? Crusade, 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 okay? Ooh, that's a mistake, okay? But you're not going to have a very good imagery of your non-Jewish neighbors in your mind. If you're living in Spain during that exact same time period, so you're going to have a very different form of interaction. It's the Golden Age of Spain. Jews, again, in large part, had a very good relationship with their Islamic hosts, okay? There was tremendous religious freedom. There was tremendous cultural freedom. Again, I'm speaking in broad strokes. But so if you're writing in Spain during that time period, you have a much different imagery of Islam, first of all, but also of the non-Jews around you, of society around you. You're much more open to culture around you because you don't feel threatened by them. Hey, if they're killing you, so you feel threatened by them. If they're nice to you, you don't feel threatened to you by them. Okay? This is all changing with the Reconquista. Okay, that's taking place throughout this whole period, where Christianity basically is moving down from France, ultimately going to take over Spain, but that happens over a period of time, culminates around the year 1270, where the Muslims are confined to a very small area that's a mistake, and the rest of Spain is essentially Christian. Okay, but this whole Christian-Islam thing is playing out, and depending on the type of relationship that you're going to have with your secular neighbors, or not secular, but your non-Jewish neighbors, is going to influence your writings. Okay? So when I put up here that the Radak lives in 1160 to 1235, well, what's taking place around those times where the Radak's living? He's basically right on the heels of the Second Crusade, and he's living during the Third Crusade and beyond. Okay? Christianity and Christian polemics are a major component in who the Radak is and why he writes his commentaries. Now, what makes the Radak unique, I was about to say so unique, but my mother is like hanging in my head right now. Right? What makes the Radak unique, my mother's an editor, right? What makes the Radak unique is that he's one of the few who incorporates Christian polemics into his writing on the Torah itself. Okay? And I'm going to give you lots of examples, and it's going to be very cool to see. So buckle up and enjoy the ride. Okay? What about a religious overview of the Radak? Again, I've been talking a lot about Spanish methodology, French methodology, and none of you remember what I'm talking about. So let me give you a little refresher, okay? When we talk about, again, when we talk about French methodology, the person we're primarily going to look at is Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, otherwise known as Rashi. Good. Rashi, as you'll notice, is basically a generation and a half, maybe two generations before Radak. But because he was one of the major players of the generation, right, Radak? Oh, now you can hear, right? But Radak is obviously going to be heavily influenced in. Just a couple of bullet points about Rashi to remind us. Rashi is going to represent the French, German, Ashkenazi traditions. He's going to combine Pshat and Drash. Let's define those terms very quickly. Okay? Pshat means that I'm going to look at the literal definition of what the verse is talking about. Okay? So if the Torah tells me that Philip walked somewhere, so I'm going to take it to mean that Philip walked somewhere. Okay? Drash is more of a midrashic. Okay? In other words, it's the way the rabbis, who maybe have struggled with the literal definition of the text, tried to, perhaps you would say even a little bit more allegorically, but they tried to find a way to understand the verse because the literal interpretation of the verse is so difficult to understand. Okay? When we talk about drash, we talk about a lot of gemaras, a lot of midrashim, that sometimes when we hear about, which my children learn in school, and you're kind of like, did that really happen? Right? How did that? So you have to understand that when the rabbis bring us that type of drash, it's to understand the pasuk in front of you, but it's not going to be in a literal sense. Okay? Rashi will combine the two. Sometimes he'll bring pshat, he'll bring what he thinks is the literal definition, and sometimes he'll struggle so much with the literal definition that he'll have to bring a drash, he'll bring a midrash to help us understand what he thinks the verse is talking about. It might not be literal. You might read that and say, that's like out of left field, but that's how Rashi reconciles an understanding of the verse. And again, I'm going to give examples, okay? And lastly, it tries to resolve textual contradictions. One verse might say one thing, one verse might say another. How are you going to reconcile the two? Okay? On the other side, right in the other corner, so we have Rav Avram Ibn Ezra, who again, you see, goes right up to the period of the Radak. The Ibn Ezra lives in Muslim Spain, so he's going to represent the other spectrum of what we're talking about tonight. He was a superb grammarian, and what I mean by that is, he saw it, I think I have that here, yeah, he's not interested in Agada. So he's not interested in any of the drash that Rashi is going to quote. He is interested in the most literal understanding of the verse, and again, I'm going to give you examples to highlight all of this as we go along. Okay? These are two, I want to say very, but two somewhat different approaches. And they represent two different schools of how to approach the Torah. Do you always assume that the Torah is literal in nature? And you have to try to figure that literal understanding out and work within the confines of the literal understanding? Or do you have a little bit of what we'll call poetic license, of drash, to help you understand the literal verse? These two don't always get along. And there is a... Okay, just making sure people are awake, right? These two don't always get along, and there's this constant tension. Now, if you learn in Spain, if you live in Spain, you're not really feeling that tension. If you live in France, you're not really feeling that tension. Where are you feeling that tension most concretely?
Provence.
In Provence, when you're living basically on the border between the two, and you're getting influenced by both sides along the way. Okay? And that is our friend the Radak. The Radak, as we'll see, is going to have components of Rashi. The Radak's going to have components of Ibn Ezra. And he's going to kind of stay his chart his own course, building upon the shoulders of these two giants. And you'll see elements of both of them in his work. Now, again, why am I showing this to you? Because I want when you read a Radak next time, or when you're in a class that references a Radak, I want you to be able to say, oh, this is the Ibn Ezra's influence on the Radak. Now I understand why the Radak is saying what he's saying. Or you'll say, this is Rashi's influence on the Radak. I understand why he reverted to a more midrashic approach. Bless you. To a more midrashic approach. Okay? Let's give a couple of examples. Oh, just to highlight a few. This is from an article by Yitzhak Berger. Not important. On one hand, he writes, Radak's family, which was of Spanish origin, produced grammatical works that exemplify the strict text-based approach. Indeed, Rav Avraham Ibn Ezra, the prominent representative of the school, influenced Radak considerably. Furthermore, Radak's dedication to Maimonidean rationalism, which has been amply demonstrated by scholars, would only have sharpened his resistance to fanciful midrashic speculation. Right? So if you're a rationalist and you look at these crazy types of midrashim, so it seems fanciful. It seems almost like imaginative. Okay? On the other hand, Radak was well acquainted with Rashi, who embraces midrashic interpretation quite regularly. In addition, Provence was the home to a school of Darshanim in this midrashic tradition, which undoubtedly had a substantial impact of the Radak. So again, you have the Ibn Ezra's influence, and you have Rashi's influence, and the Radak is kind of the melting pot of the two. Let's see a couple of examples. Please look at your source sheets. Page 1, source 1. Okay? I took them away, but I'm sure, can you share with them? Thank you. Okay. No one has to pay attention to the Hebrew. There is English for absolutely everything in this source booklet. I wouldn't have it any other way. And I will only be reading English. Why do I give you the Hebrew then? Because we should have Hebrew. We're a people of the book. If you want to learn it on your own later, you have it in front of you. I wouldn't want to rob you of that experience. Okay? And sometimes the English is pathetic, and I might actually read the Hebrew and translate it for you. Okay? Let's look at example number one. The verse says, and again, I don't bring the verse because I don't want to get too involved in the detail. But the verse says that the poles of the ark were visible. And then in the exact same verse, it says, but they cannot be seen from the outside. So if you read a verse like this, and you're an intelligent person, what are you saying to yourself? That's contradictory, right? How could it be visible, but also not seen? And so what do the sages say in a midrashic vein, second line in English? How so? They pressed up against the curtain and protruded outward, so that they looked, we're all adults here, like two breasts of a woman, as it says, he sleeps between my breasts. Okay, so that's how the Midrash understands the verse. Okay? The ark is pushed up against the curtain, and so on the one hand, it's not visible, because you can't see it, there's a curtain, but on the other hand, you see it protruding outward. See where I have my underline. This is a commentary of the Radak. But we have no need for this Midrashic interpretation. Okay, the Radak says, what do I need this medrash for? And he goes on, we're not going to read inside, but he says that I can figure out a way to reconcile the verse in a strictly literal fashion. Okay, so you see, he quotes the Midrash, he's familiar with it, okay, but he doesn't want to rely upon it. He wants to rely upon a literal verse. But then look what he says at the last two lines of the English. He says that those who said this, namely the Midrash, knew what they were saying, for their intellect ranged beyond ours. So you see, within this one commentary of the Radak on Divrei Hayamim, this tension between Midrash and literal. He's familiar with Midrash. He's even comfortable quoting it. But he rejects it. And then after he rejects it, he says, but don't think I'm being flippant in my rejection, because there are those who would be flippant in the rejection of Midrash. If you read certain commentaries of Ibn Ezra, you would think that Midrash was like heresy. So the Radak says, I'm not willing to do that because I am, what we would say in Hebrew, makshiv. I give credibility, I give importance to the Midrash and the people who do rely upon it, namely Rashi. So they know what they're doing and their intellect rages beyond ours. Okay, so that's one text where you see this interplay, you see this tension between Midrash and literalism. Okay, go to page 2, source 2. Again, this is another example, perhaps an even more clear example, of the interplay between Rashi, Radak, and Ibn Ezra as it relates to Midrash in the literal translation. For those of you who remember back to Parsha Toldo, which was about 6 weeks ago, not 6 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, I don't know, time flies when you're having fun, okay? So you remember back to Parsha Toldo. Rivka is pregnant with how many children?
Two.
Yaakov and Esau. What is happening inside her womb? There's some fighting going along. So what does Rivka do?
She consults.
She consults. Oh, good. Who does she consult? So as, right, my dear friend over here is quoting Rashi. If you look where it says Rashi, that first source on page number 2, just that last line. And she went to inquire to the Academy of Shame. In other words, she went to one of the yeshivot of the time period, to one of the great rabbis, to ask, what is this in my stomach? There's this rumbling, right? It's not indigestion. It's not the food that I bought from, not going to mention any names, right? But it's not that food, right? But she can't figure it out. Tums isn't working and acids aren't working. So she goes to yeshiva, she goes to Rabbi Goldberg, and she says, Rabbi Goldberg, why does my stomach hurt? Okay? Now, if you'll notice in the English, what does it say in the brackets? Agadat Breshit. Who is Rashi quoting to understand this verse? He is quoting a Midrash. Now, why does Rashi quote a Midrash? Because all the verse tells us is that she went to inquire. There's a lot uncertain about that verse. Why did she go to inquire? Who did she go to inquire? Where did she... The text doesn't tell me any of that. Okay? So Rashi relies upon a Midrash to fill in the blanks of a text. What does the Radak say? Look in the next source, and we're just going to read that last underline in the English. He says, and she went, perhaps Abraham was in a different house with Keturah, who was his second wife, and her children. Now what did the Radak just do? According to the Radak, Rivka never went to Rabbi Goldberg. Who did she go to?
Avraham.
Now, is that more literal or is that more midrashic? It's much more literal. What's Radak basically saying? Why, Rashi, are you relying on this midrash that she traveled far to go to Rabbi Goldberg, right? Avraham, who was alive, and I didn't read the whole thing, but he proves that Avraham was still alive, is living next door. It must be that she simply went next door. That's the more logical, literal interpretation. Now, where would Radak have gotten that concept from? Why would he have assumed that it was so close by? Well, look, this one is actually not translated. Sorry. Look at Ibn Ezra. Mm-hmm. Okay? Ibn Ezra is not on this verse. The Ibn Ezra is on a verse that we're going to read in a few weeks, in the beginning of Sefer Shmot, where it says, Vayelech ish mi beit Levi, Rabbi Kisrola vayikach et bat Levi. He's humble. Rabbi Kisrola knows the verse for sure. Okay? That a man from Levi went to a woman from Levi. Now the verse is bizarre. What does it mean they went? Where did they go? So again, Rashi has this whole, I'm bringing for you this whole long story. Okay? That the daughters came and they said, Daddy, you got to get out of the house. Don't punish mommy just because the Egyptians are being mean to us. Fills in this whole story based on a midrash. What does Ibn Ezra say? Ibn Ezra says it's quite simple. Where did he go? It must be that there were a lot of different houses. And that, and if you wanted to, the same way, right? Before email and phone, if you wanted to talk to someone, what'd you do? You went next door. So Ibn Ezra says it must be that when it says that a man went to meet the woman, it's not this whole convoluted story. It's simply he had to go next door to meet her. He had to go on a date. They had to go to the restaurant together. So Radak, who's familiar with these comments, okay, who understands the Vayelech, that Ibn Ezra references later on in a very literal term, he simply takes the exact same methodology and applies it over here. And he says, I'm not going to rely on Rashi's Midrash, which he quotes, by the way, because he's familiar with it. Okay, he quotes it. But he says, I'm not going to rely upon that. I'm going to rely on a much more literal definition. Here you have an example of Radak interplay with Rashi Ibn Ezra, choosing between Midrash, which he's familiar with, and ultimately a more literal translation. Okay? Up until now, all that I've done for you is discussed one component of the Radak. And I'm going to summarize it, and then we're going to go on. Okay, the Radak lived in Provence. The point of contact, essentially, between France and Spain, somewhat of a melting pot. Therefore, he was influenced by French personalities and Christian Spanish personalities. This plays itself out when we talk about Rashi and Ibn Ezra, which greatly informed the commentary of the Radak. So number one thing you have to know about the Radak is this struggle between literal and Midrash. Who here is warm? Okay, I'll put my phone away then. No one's warm? Okay, I guess it's just me. Okay, next. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I just want to reference it to you. If you look at source number three, page number three. Okay? We can read this on our own. Again, I really do not want to spend time on it. The Radak, in a number of his commentaries, presents us with a very realistic impression of our forefathers and foremothers. Is that the word for it? Foremothers? Matriarchs and patriarchs? Matriarchs and patriarchs.
Mamas and
okay?
Papas.
What?
The mamas and the papas.
The mamas and the papas, okay? Here I just gave you one quick example where the verse says that Sarah mistreated Hagar. If you look in the bottom of your Arts Ruchumis this Shabbos, you will notice that the commentary is all bent over backwards to say Sarah wasn't really so mean. How could you assume that such a holy woman would be mean to her maidservant? The Radak says not only was she mean, she was oppressively mean. She was overbearingly mean. She acted inappropriately. And he says at the end, this story is written in the Torah so that one may adopt the good traits and avoid the bad ones. Very honest interpretation. Many commentaries are reluctant to do that. In fact, they try to get bind into a pretzel to get themselves out of ever having to associate a negative characteristic with our matriarchs and patriarchs. Radak was very comfortable doing it, and I just gave you one source there. I'm going to skip the next one and go to the Radak as a polemist. Okay, the rest of the class, the next 42 minutes, is all going to be about Radak as a polemist. To me, in the preparing this, is the most interesting part. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievably theologically, it's unbelievable what the Radak said and why he said it and how he was treated because he said it. I want to share with you two comments, okay, made about the Radak, both found in Christian sources. Number one, this is the commentaries of Solomon and Kimi, that's our guy, and Rabbi, I'm not even going to try, to the Old Testament. Both the Hebrew and Latin translation, .. In these works are contained things contrary to our faith, especially in regard to the prophets. Okay? The Christians knew who the Radak was. They were bothered by how the Radak was writing what he was writing, and the overt anti-Christian rhetoric that plays into what he's writing. And therefore you have people like Michael Servetus. I don't know how to pronounce that, but he was a famous heretic in the 16th century. And even he, a famous heretic, says the following: I am unable to restrain myself from tears when I see the replies which are made concerning the Trinity by Rabbi Kimchi against the Christians. For I see the absurd reasons with which they combat him, and I cannot but choose to weep. Okay, so you see there's this tremendous amount of emotions playing into what the Radak wrote. Here's an image of a manuscript of the Radak in his commentary on Tehillim. Most of his anti-Christian polemics are going to be found in his commentary on Tehillim. And you see over here, it's a little hard to see, but hopefully you can see, that it's all what it's censored. Okay, it's all written over. It's all scribbled over. And this was not a random occurrence within the commentaries of the Radak. A lot of what the Radak wrote, specifically his anti-Christian rhetoric, was simply censored out of the generations. It was subsequently reprinted in a book called Vikuchei HaRadak. Okay? And in most contemporary editions of the Navi, it's put back in. Okay? So it's easily defined, but in the Middle Ages, I just want to give you a sense, this is just one page, and look at almost his entire commentary over here. It's completely blacked out. Because the church doesn't want you and me and Christians to see what the Radak's going to say. Because what he's going to do is take what the Christians are doing to Tehillim and basically how they use Tanakh to prove Jesus, the Passion, the Virgin Birth. And the Radak in his commentary says, in very overt ways, he references Jesus, he references the Christians. Most commentaries don't do that. He, in a very overt way, he debunks the way they misuse Torah. Okay? The Radak employed five types of arguments in his anti-Christian polemic. Number one, the context of the passage disproves such an interpretation. So I'll give you a quick example, okay, which I'm not going to bring here, but I gave a class on it. Some of you might be familiar with it. You'll remember it like it was yesterday. You know how I know? Because it was 2 years ago, Shavuos night at 2 in the morning. If there's anything you're ever going to remember, it's a 2 in the morning class on Shavuos night 2 years ago. I'm sure it's etched right in your mind. But a good example of this is Isaiah 53, which is the suffering servant. Is Mr. Siegel here? Ah, right there, right? The author of the book that I ripped off to make my class on Isaiah the suffering servant. One of the things that the Christians do to the chapter of the suffering servant is, right, suffering servant. That sounds a lot like Jesus. Let's make that Jesus. Okay? One of the things you have to understand is the context within which the suffering servant prophecy is given, which is a whole series, right? Am I mistreating this? It's a whole series of prophecies all having to do with the Jewish people. So if you take it out of context, and I were to just tell you there's a suffering servant, you'd say, wait a second, I think I told this story back then. Rabbi Brody, who's the outreach rabbi here at BRS, was having a conversation with a friend who, they were having coffee, and the friend whips out Tanakh and says, Rabbi Brody, how can you disagree with Christianity? Here's chapter 53 in Isaiah. Read the English translation, it's a suffering servant. So Rabbi Brody comes running into my office one day. He goes, Phil, my whole faith is upside down, right? How can you reconcile? It says suffering servant. It's all about Jesus. I said, Josh. I said, here's Mr. Siegel's book. Go read it. But again, if you understand outside of context, it sounds a lot like Christianity. Inside of context, it disproves that interpretation. Okay, Radak is going to, in his commentary, highlight that for us. Number two, the biblical text has been corrupted by Christians. Okay? For example, they will take a word which in all of Tanakh has one translation, and they'll mistranslate it, basically. Or change a letter to better suit the way they want to understand. And I'm going to give examples for all of these, but I just want to go through them quickly. Number three, their interpretation leads to a dilemma. Okay? He will, in a very overt fashion, talk about the virgin birth. And he'll describe childbirth. And how, at that time, scientists understood childbirth. And he'll say, if you believe in the virgin birth, it simply doesn't make sense. Okay? It leads to a dilemma. It causes a contradiction. Number four, allegorical interpretation is untenable in this instance. Okay? So, for example, Christians might say, very nice, I'm going to change sides just so that people aren't here. Okay? Very nice that Christians believe that the Torah might not be meant to be taken literally at this point. It might be it's supposed to be taken a little bit more allegorically, but he'll say it can't be allegorically here. And this is for the following reasons why. Okay? And last but not least, the doctrine propounded is irrational. Okay, he's going to talk about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Okay, again, you very rarely see biblical commentaries that writing in such overt fashion about the Trinity. And he'll say, how could the Son be the Father? How can a divinity have a Son? And we're going to read it. He goes in a very in-your-face, overt way where he disproves or debunks what the Christians are trying to do to our text. Now, if you're a Pope, if you're a Christian at the time and you're reading the Radak's writings, you are not happy with it. Okay? You are not happy with him, and you want to do everything possible to make sure that your population does not see what the Radak is writing. Okay? Because the greatest antidote to all of this is education. And you don't want people to know how the Radak is using it. Okay. The context of the passage. I just realized I need to be back on this side. Sorry, over there. Next week. Next time. Okay? The context of a verse. Let's read a verse from Isaiah 7:14. You could Google it, and you will get 6,325,000 blah, blah, blah. Christian interpretations, Christian websites about this text. Okay? Isaiah 7:14 says the following. Lachem yitain Adonai hu lachem os. God will give you a sign. Okay, this is talking about Achaz. The context is not as important for us, and we'll see in a second. I don't want to get bogged down. Hine ha'alma. I'm sorry. The context is really important, but the broader Tanakhi context is less important. Okay. Hine ha'alma hara. The alma, which we're not going to translate, hara conceived, violated bain. She gave birth to a child. Vikarat shmo Immanuel. Okay. Now. The author's translation, I believe this is from Art Scroll maybe. Therefore the Lord will give him a sign, will give you a sign. Here, the young woman, Alma, is young woman. Hara is pregnant. And she shall give birth to a son. And you, namely the young woman, shall call his name Immanuel. Okay, the two major things we have to notice here is the word Ot, sign, and Ha'alma. What this author translated as the young woman. Okay? Now you'll see in King James' version of the Old Testament and the New Testament, that translation changes dramatically. So for example, therefore the Lord shall give you a sign. Okay? Behold, a virgin shall conceive. Is that the way my Jewish text over here translates it? Okay. What's the major point of distinction? How to understand this word right here. Ha'alma. Okay. Okay. Is that a young woman? Is that a virgin? What does hara mean? Is it is pregnant or shall conceive? Okay. So you see you have one text in different translations of the text. Please look at your source sheets, page 4, source number 5. Okay. And you'll see on your source sheets, I wrote which slide it is, that if you're going over it afterwards, you can easily match up the sources to the slides. Okay? This is the Radak's commentary on this verse. So first, and this I didn't translate, I'll just tell it to you outside. The Radak says, first and foremost, that Alma, which the King James Version translates as a virgin, so Radak says it doesn't necessarily mean virgin. And as he brings examples where most of the time it means a young woman. Okay? A young woman and a virgin have very different connotations within Judaism and Christianity. Okay? But then he goes on, and this is where I have the English, it's the second paragraph in the Hebrew we're just going to read. The context refutes their words. Again, this is an example of the context of the passage disproves such an interpretation. Okay? How do we know this can't be talking about Jesus? So Radak says, I'll show you how. The context refutes their words explicitly. For Achaz, who's the person of the day, again, it's not as important who he was afraid that these two kings, might take Yerushalayim. He was nervous that these kings were going to gather up against him and overtake Yerushalayim. God, therefore, gave him a sign so that he might have faith that they would not do so. Okay, God does that oftentimes in the Torah. When Moshe is going to get down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, Moshe says, give me a sign that this is going to be a worthwhile endeavor. So God gives him a sign. Right? It's not the first time people have asked for signs. So Achaz asks for a sign. Now listen to what the Radak says. If this sign was Jesus, as they say, okay, who's the they? Obviously the Christians. What meaning did this have for Achaz? Again, Achaz wanted a sign in real time that God was going to carry out what he said. He said, how could he be encouraged by something that did not happen in his own time and was not to come for another 400 years? So Radak says, even if you want to argue that Alma means a virgin, okay, which he says is wrong, but let's say you even want to argue, the context of the verse overtly disproves that. Because why would God be promising Jesus to Achaz at this moment? Right? Okay. Horribly insulted. I'm just telling you. They told me they were leaving at the beginning. Okay. Just joking. Sorry. Forgive me. Okay? Right? So he says the context of the verse. Yeah, take two. The context. Oh, there's one. Two. The context of the verses, he says, simply disproves that this could be talking about Jesus, because how could that be a sign? It's not going to happen for 400 years. That's like you telling me, Philip, I'll make you a deal. I promise you I'm going to give you a new car. Okay? Tomorrow. Okay? So I say, how do I know you're going to keep your word? So if you say, well, in 345 years from now, right, my ancestry will give you a watch as collateral if I don't give you the car. You know what I'm going to say to you? That's the most absurd thing on the planet. But again, according to the Radak, that's exactly what you would be saying now if you say the oat, the sign here, is talking about Jesus. Okay, so it's an example of where the context of the passage clearly, at least in the Radak's mind, clearly disproves what Christianity was trying to do to this verse to prove Jesus in the Bible. Okay, that's example number one. Example number two. Okay. Number two was, the biblical text has been corrupted by Christians. Okay, so again, the text itself, not the context, but the text. Here's a verse from Sefer Tehillim. Okay, the book of Psalms. Kisiv avuni kalavim adat mereim hikifuni kari yadivar agli. Okay, I'm not translating that on purpose. Why aren't I translating that on purpose? Because my translation is useless here. You guys didn't come here to hear my translation. You came to hear everyone else's translation. So here we go. Okay, option number one. This is the JPS. One of perhaps the most authoritative and literal translations. This is how JPS translates it. For dogs have encompassed me. A company of evildoers have enclosed me. Like a lion, they are at my hands and my feet. What imagery does that conjure up? Okay. What imagery does that conjure up? Does anyone understand the JPS translation? Okay. No. Okay. Does anyone understand it?
The evildoers sound like dogs.
Okay, so they're evildoers. They're encompassing me. What does it mean they're
surrounding
me? Surrounding me, okay?
They're threatening me.
Like a lion. Is a lion a very friendly image or a non-friendly one?
Non-friendly.
Not a friendly image, right? So they're like a lion. They're at my hands and my feet, right? You picture the lion is tied up to a chain. Right, and he's right. You know, they used to do that to scare. I mean, I think that's one of the things that got America into trouble. We still did that with dogs, right? Okay? Anyone wants to scare me, you do that to me to a dog, okay? But that's right, you have the imagery. The lion is charging at you, and he's getting right up to your hands and feet. And what are you doing if you're the prisoner at that time?
Right.
You're recoiling, defecating on yourself, any of the above. No, but that's what you wanted to accomplish, right? You wanted to make the person scared, okay? Listen to what the King James Bible does to this verse. Okay? For dogs have encompassed me. So far, so good. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. So far, so good. They pierced my hands and my feet.
Pierced?
Wait a second. Which word was supposed to be like a lion? Ke'ari. And Ari is a lion. Like a lion, yadai v'raglai, my hands and my feet. Where do they get the pierced? Where do they get it from? So you and I are shaking their heads because you didn't prepare this, but I did, so I know the answer. And the answer is as follows. Oh, hey, the answer is as follows. This is from a very Christian website, which is why I cited him, but made it very small, because no one should go to this. Okay. It's basically every reason why you should become Christian. Okay? So, an ancient controversy has surfaced once again in our times. It revolves around the text. Again, this is our proof where they... Right, well, what do we have here? The biblical text has been corrupted. Okay? It revolves around the text. In the Hebrew Masoretic text, the verse reads, "For dogs have encircled me, an evil congregation surrounded me, like a lion my hands and my feet." Okay? However, okay, this is now the Greek, the Christian translation. Do not read the word ka'ari, like a lion, but rather ka'aru, which means they dug. And thus they translated the word with the Greek word. My mom would know what this means. They dug or they pierced. The difference was whether the original word ended with a vav, which would be a ka'aru, or a yud, which is Ka'ari. Okay? Okay? Now look at your source sheet.
1 second.
Yeah.
Tehillim chapter 2, the last possum, Nashkubal. How do you translate that? Well, they translate it, kiss the sun.
So again, I could have given you 600 million examples. I'm giving you, I mean, how many books do you have out now?
Eight.
My dear friend Gerald Siegel over here has 8 books, where most of them probably deal with all of these verses so far. Yeah. So you could read all of his books. Okay? My goal here is to help you understand what the Radak is trying to do. So this is not a class about Christianity, which I'm happy to give it another time. This is a class about the Radak. And the Radak actually does comment on it. But I want to give you categories. Because again, no one's going to leave this room knowing every comment the Radak ever makes. I want to help you understand methodologically what the Radak is trying to do. And so I'm giving you specific examples to each one. Okay. Look at page number 5, source number 6. And I'm happy to learn the Radak inside with you, by the way. That wasn't like a blowing you off. That was just a, we don't have time now. I'm happy to learn the Radak inside. Okay? Because most Radak does not have English translation. And I'm happy to do it with anyone who wants. Listen to what the Radak says. We'll just read the English. Source number 6, page number 5. A band of evildoers have encircled me, like a lion, my hands and my feet. For they have encircled me like a lion encircles his prey in the jungle with his tail. Any animal which finds itself in this circle will not depart out of dread and fear of the lion. Right? If the lion is keeping you imprisoned, you're not going anywhere. Okay? For me, that is like being a house with a dog. Okay? The single way to keep me in a room is having a dog in the other room. Okay? So he says, if the lion's there, you're not going to leave. Instead, they draw in their hands and feet so that the lion preys on them inside the circle. In other words, if there's a lion surrounding you, so you're not going to be like, oh, come here, bite my fingers off, right? You're going to recoil a little bit. You're going to keep yourself inside the circle. Similarly, says the Radak, we in exile are inside the circle so that we cannot leave it without falling into the hands of the predators. For if we leave the domain of the Ishmaelites, we will fall into the domain of the uncircumcised. Behold, we gather in our hands and feet, stand in fear and dread of them. For we have no right to flee with our feet and fight with our hands. And therefore, it is as if our hands and feet are in fetters. Okay? What did the Radak do? Well, clearly, the Radak goes out of his way to showcase that it's talking about a lion and not the alternative. Okay? What does he do in a more ironic sense, though? Not only does he say that this verse is talking about a lion, but who's the verse? He turns it right on its head. Right? He's talking about Islam, Muslims and Christians. And basically, right? In other words, the exact verse that they used to prove Jesus, right? That he was pierced with his hands and his feet, right? Radak says, no, that's not, we're talking about you. You are the ones who are oppressing us, and therefore we are like them. Okay? So again, he's taking the Kari and showing that it can't be talking about Jesus. And I'll show you another example of this in a second. It can't be talking about a lion. I mean, it has to be talking about a lion. It can't mean pierced. And not only that, but it's an anti-Christian rhetoric in general. Because the uncircumcised are the Christians. That's how he refers to them there. Okay? So it's not just a polemic against the way they try to interpret the verse, which I'll show you another source he rails against in a much more overt fashion, but it's even an anti-Christian verse. Because he's saying, don't think that this is about Jesus, it's about you guys torturing us. We the Jews are the ones who have to keep our hands and feet in. And you the ones are encircling us, and you are the lion, and we are the ones who have to keep our hands and feet in. Okay?
Ka'aru has a meaning to the word ka'aru. Ka'aru. Is that has any meaning, this word?
So it apparently means they dug in Greek.
In Hebrew, ka'aru, instead of ka'ari.
What about it?
By changing that.
Means they dug.
Meaning to that
they
word?
Dug.
It says up there.
They dug. That's what it says. They dug or they pierced. Okay? From the Greek word aruxin. I don't know what that means.
But in Hebrew it has no meaning.
Okay.
Ka'aru. What's ka'aru?
Okay. Number 3. Their interpretation leads to a dilemma. So look at page number 6, source number 7. Okay? Again, this is simply a way of saying that the way they interpret a text, again, these are all comments of the Radak. This is not me. I'm simply showing how the Radak used his commentary as a polemic against Christianity. Okay? In the methods in which he did it. So source number 7. Again, the context of the verse is not important. But look. 9 lines from the top of the English. Right in the middle of the line is the word also. Okay? Now this verse, this paragraph of Psalms, starts off, Keli, Keli, lama azavtani. God, God, why have you forsaken me? Okay? And in the verse, also the verse, in his soul he hath not kept alive, which in Hebrew is v'nafsho lo chaya, has led them astray. Again, this is very, right? This is dangerous stuff to be writing about. Okay? I mean, this is like, you're basically contradicting everything they're saying. He says, this has led them astray. For they say that this one is God, before whom all who go down to the dust shall bow. And he, namely Jesus, did not wish to keep his soul alive because he came down to assume human flesh conditionally that they might kill the flesh. In other words, Jesus wanted to die. The condition upon which he came down to earth was so that he could die to atone for the sins. And that by this, those who go down to Gehenna might be saved. Right? And by Jesus dying, he can provide salvation for those who are otherwise going to burn in hell. So forsooth. Okay? I have no idea what forsooth. He did not desire to keep his soul alive, but surrendered himself into the power of those who slew him. Right? Jesus never wanted to stay alive. He wanted to die. That was part of the plan all along. By him diving, he provides salvation. Now here I have my underline. Now let them hear what is involved in their words. Okay, he's calling out Christians. He's saying, they say that he did not wish to keep his soul alive nor rescue it from the power of those who slew him. If he says, again, don't forget, this is the category of it leads to a dilemma. If you argue that Jesus wanted to die the whole time, if so, why did he cry, my God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Right? Eli, Eli, lama azavtani. Why art thou so far helping me? Okay? If he had no desire to be saved, Jesus wanted to die, he wouldn't have called out to God. He would have, in fact, hastened it. Has he not forgotten the condition of taking his flesh? In other words, the verse in the psalm directly contradicts what they wanted to use the exact same psalm for. It creates a dilemma. Okay, let's go on. He says also, but that house not answered me. You didn't answer me. And perhaps does not wish to be answered. And further, if he were really God, he would be able to save himself. Right? If Jesus were a God, what does he need to call out to God for? He could save himself. And further, when he says the praises of Israel, when it is they who are doing him evil. Right? How could he be praising Israel in the exact same psalm that he's lamenting that they're punishing him? How could he say that they are praising, right, dot, 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 dot. So on and so forth. And again, this is just an excerpt. So again, what do you see? He takes a psalm. He takes two verses in the exact same psalm. One that says, v'nafsho lo chaya, that his soul didn't want to live. The other that says, Eli, Eli, lama azavtani, God, why are you forsaking me? And he says those two are contradictory of each other. It creates a dilemma for us. Either Jesus never wanted to be alive, v'nafsho lo chaya, he came down to this earth to be killed, to be a salvation, or he wants to be saved by God and he's calling out to God. But you can't have both. Okay? So again, what do you see? This is a very... Again, I want to try to communicate that this stuff may or may not sit well with you here, but if you're living during the time of the Crusades, and you're using your commentary, which was, as I said, he was the Rashi of Nach. He was the most prominent biblical commentary of his time. Not just of his time, I forgot to mention this at the beginning. From the year 1000 to 1200, there is a different grammatical work written on the Torah about every 25 or 30 years. Once the Radak writes his works, another one is not written for another 500 years. Okay? The Radak was a major personality. He was very authoritative and he was studied widely, both inside Jewish circles and in Christian circles. And that's why he utilizes his text, and other people duck this type of stuff. He goes right at it. Right, he must have had a lifetime contract in whatever shul he was in. Because he was not afraid of his board. Okay? He was not afraid of what the board was going to say about him. Okay? But again, you see, very clear, very overt, not afraid to reference Jesus, not afraid to reference Christian doctrine, and not afraid to argue with it. Okay? That's example number three. Example number four. Allegorical interpretation is untenable in this instance. So again, turn the page to source number eight. Now, not every class is going to be as text-based as this class is tonight. But you simply can't get the flavor. You can't get the what I'll call the neshama, the soul of the Radak, unless you see the way he writes it. Because that's as important as to what he writes. It's important the way he writes it. You have to understand. So he says here, then again, the context of what he's writing is not as important. And not like the Christian heretics. The verse is talking about the Torah is going to omed eslad, it's going to be forever. So he says, and not like the Christian heretics who say that the Torah was given at Mount Sinai was valid only until the advent of Jesus. For until his time it was to be taken literally, and when he came, he commanded that it be taken allegorically. Okay? In other words, up until the time of Jesus, the Old Testament was the text that was going to be used. After the New Testament comes along, what do you do with the Old Testament? So you can't completely disregard it. You say it must be meant allegorically. Once it's allegorical, so it's a little bit left up to interpretation. You have a lot more poetic license in there. Okay? So he writes here, their words are wind and vanity. Wow. Hey, that'll get you. That'll earn you a... I don't know what that'll earn. It's not a good thing. Okay? For the commandments, now why can't it be that way, he says, for the commandments, which they say are allegory, not to be taken literally, were specifically commanded by God. In other words, God commanded the Old Testament, he says. If the commandments were allegorical, their intent would be uncertain, and everyone would be of a different opinion concerning them. In other words, he says, why would God tell us something that would be allegorical, which leads itself for multiple interpretation? God would never do that, he said. Therefore, he says, if God commanded us in the Torah, it must be because God wants us to understand it literally and not allegorically. So again, an example of where allegorical interpretation is untenable in this instance. He says you simply can't disregard the entire written Torah as allegorical in nature because that undermines the very fact that God himself told it to us. Okay? And last but not least, the doctrine propounded is irrational. Now here it's interesting, because he does not use the text itself to show that Christian theology is wrong. Okay, those were my first few examples. What does he say now? It just doesn't make sense. That's a very bold thing to point out. Okay, especially when you're living in a Christian society where the Christians don't need a lot of excuses to create more pogroms and to run through the town and murder all of you. Okay? So listen to what he writes. Sources 9 and 10, the last two sources. And then we'll do a quick review. This is from his Vikuach Laharadak, and the reason why I quoted from there and not from his commentary itself, we're on page 8, the last page. Okay? Source number 9, slide 22. Okay? Is because not everything was later put back into the biblical commentary. Okay? So he writes here the following. I, the insignificant one, have seen fit to write briefly concerning some of the notions of those who err in saying that Mary conceived Jesus without normal intercourse. Again, if you don't want to make a friend with a devout Christian, right? If you want to stop the conversation at one of the holiday parties, that's a good line to start with. Right? By the way, the virgin birth makes no sense. Okay? They say too that the annunciating angel Gabriel said to her, I'm not going to practice my Latin for you. At that moment, the Holy Spirit of the Lord entered through her ear so that she conceived. Right? That's how they believe she conceived. Reply to them. Now again, who is he talking to when he says reply to them? Jews. Right? He's giving Jews who are confused by different... Don't forget, you didn't have like the internet. You didn't have Gerald Siegel back then. If you were living in your little shtetl and your Christian neighbor is having coffee with you telling you about Christian theology, it could be very confusing. You can't just run to the internet and say, responses to Isaiah 7:14, which is how I prepared this class. No, I'm just joking. I prepared this class a little bit more intellectually, right? But you have that ability now. You can go on chat rooms. You can email world-class scholars. You couldn't do that back then. So Radak is writing to Jews to say, this is how you respond to them. Okay? Reply to them. That every intelligent person knows that the young, right, the birds and the bees, that the young of all creatures, right, you're going to go home tonight and your friend's going to say what you learned about. You're going to learn about Jesus and birds and the bees, procreation, okay? That the young of all creatures, whether man, animal, fowl, or beast, leaves the mother's body from the place where the semen entered. Therefore, Jesus should have left through the ear, through which the Holy Spirit entered the womb. Yet he did not leave from there, but from the place where all others left. Okay? Now again, we laugh. But I would venture to say that if we invited our friends from the Broward Pastors Network, Pastor Mario Bramnick, our dear friend who we collaborate on with many Israel activism activities, he probably wouldn't be laughing right now. Right? And I wouldn't give this class to him, honestly. Now, the reason why I wouldn't be laughing is because it's offensive to him. It's offensive to Christian theology. The Radak was very aware, and this is not me saying, I can show you articles that prove it. The Radak was very aware that Christians were reading his text. He knew he was being censored. It takes a really big guy with broad shoulders to be able to write what we just read. Okay? And last, source number 10. This is from the end of his commentary on chapter 3 of Psalms of David. He says, the very verse which the Christians bring as a proof text in the support for their error is their own stumbling block. Again, it's irrational. This verse is, the Lord said unto me, thou art my son. Okay, which of course, Christians are going to use to understand that Jesus is the Son of God. Okay? Born through a virgin birth. When they tell you that he was the Son of God, tell them that it is impossible to say that the horse is the son of Reuben. Now, why can't a horse be the son of Reuben? Because a horse is a horse, of course, right? We all know that, okay? And Reuben is a human being. Human beings can't give birth to horses. Now, by the way, I don't believe the Radak used a horse accidentally. Hey, a horse is not the most flattering of all animals to choose. Okay? He's comparing, obviously, Jesus to the horse here. And if so, he to whom God says, thou art my son, must be of him and divine like him. In other words, if Jesus is God's son, then Jesus has to be a God. Scripture further says, this day have I begotten thee, and the procreated is of the same species as the procreator. Tell them that there can be no father and son in the divinity. How can both God and Jesus be gods? For the divinity is indivisible. Right? God is one. If God is only one, then how can he be multiple gods? And is one in a very... Now again, Christians can respond to all of this. I understand that. But the Radak is giving the Jews what to respond back. He said, and is one in every aspect of unity, unlike matter which is divisible. I could take this table and split it up into two. I can't take God and split it up to two. Tell them further that a father precedes a son in time, and a son is born through the agency of a father. Now, even though the terms father and son imply each other, he who is called the father must undoubtedly be prior in time. Therefore, with reference to this God, whom you call Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, that part which you call Father must be prior to that which you call Son, for if they were always coexistent, they would have been called twin brothers. Okay? Again, another example of where he doesn't bring texts in the verse necessarily. He doesn't bring Gemaras, he doesn't bring rabbis. He's simply saying that the text itself is irrational. Okay? So what I gave you is five, again, I could stay here till midnight giving you examples. Five examples of how the Radak, through his commentary, uses it to systematically undermine Christianity. In the methodology through which he does it. The context, the text itself, the verbiage, ka'aru, ka'ari, irrational, etc., etc., etc. And now to summarize in the last 5 minutes, which I promised myself I'd be able to do tonight. Okay. We saw a brief review and historical background. Okay? We understood the difference between France and Spain, both in terms of their relationship with the Christians around them, and you understand now that the Radak is writing in France at the exact same time as all those crusades that I underlined. Okay? Which is why he's so anti-Christian. Okay? I'm not convinced you would get that same rhetoric coming out of Spain. Okay, first of all, they weren't as influenced by Christianity, but second of all, they were much more welcomed into broader society. We learned the difference between Rashi, who was of French Ashkenazi origin, and Ibn Ezra, who was from Spanish origin. We learned how that fusion of the two of them in Provence, the melting pot of France and Spain, greatly influenced Radak when it came to the literal or midrashic understanding of text. I brought you two examples. The example of the ark, I believe, was the example I brought.
Yeah?
And the example of Rifko going out, where Rashi understands it midrashically. Radak bases himself off of Ibn Ezra, understands it very literally, and says, I don't really want to use midrash. But you see that he always, he gives chashivas, he gives credibility to the midrash. Remember he said, even those who understand it midrashically, they know far more than I do. We saw that the Radak has a very realistic approach to the forefathers. Right? Didn't try to hide or conceal or reinterpret, but he was very honest in his interpretation of the faults and flaws of our patriarchs and matriarchs, because he wants us to learn from them. He says, flaws are okay. That's a realistic model that we can derive inspiration from. I didn't go into this, Kriyu Kativ, but I'll do it in 2 seconds or less. You'll notice sometimes in the text that the text of the Torah is written one way, but said another way. Okay, written one way, but when the Baal Kori, when the person reading the Torah, will read it a different way. And so if one Bible was given to Moshe at Har Sinai, how could you have a discrepancy in the text? So the Radak comes along with a majorly problematic idea, where he says basically that throughout exile, the Jewish people lost the correct text. And when Ezra came, brought everyone back and basically tried to put the Torah back together, there were divergent opinions in certain cases about what the actual text of the Torah should be. So the Radak says, instead of having to pick and choose, they simply brought both. One was written and one was verbalized. That's a very interesting, it's a whole class in and of itself, because theologically that presents a whole slew of problems for us. If we believe that the Torah we have now is the Torah given to Moses at Har Sinai. And lastly, and this was the bulk, the last 45 minutes of the class, was the Radak as a polemist. And again, those five categories of how the Radak did. Why did I spend so much time on the Radak as a polemist? A, because I think it's the most interesting thing, and I think it's very relevant for us. But more importantly, you meet someone on the street and mention the word Radak, they probably will not be familiar with bullet points 1, 2, 3, 4. They might be familiar with number 5. If you ask me what makes the Radak different than any other biblical commentary in Jewish history, it is Radak as a polemist. Some wrote works that were anti-Christian. For example, the Ramban, we know, was involved in many anti-Christian polemics. But the Ramban doesn't incorporate it into his interpretation of the Torah. The Radak does. That makes him unique. Literally throughout Jewish history, he's one of the only major personalities that does that. And that's why you can't understand the Radak without understanding his polemical nature. And that's why I spent so much time on it this afternoon. I'm going to end the class now. I'm going to stay after for questions. Anyone who wants is welcome to come up. I hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you next week. Don't forget to take the slideshows if you're interested. Yes.
About where you, especially coming back,
about. Keep it all together. That's why I'm
about the.
Grab a bunch.
Yes.
I understand that the piercing the change from we keep all into piercing. The word Ari, the change into Ari. So they completely disregard what the word means. So Ari has nothing in Hebrew. They don't care about it.
word Karu, the olive, is indicates the kamatze. That's the Mao text. They read it Karu, meaning as a verb, not as a letter.
That was really
interesting. That was a problem. Karu, like
more? Opening out your hands.
I don't get it.
Is that all you need?
No, that's
opening out your hands.
Yes. What do you know about
me? One for Carol and one for myself.
What do you know about me?
Carol. And one for myself.
And one for
yourself. Let me give that thing back.
Thank you.
So do you have anybody else?
Not the only one who says it.
You're all set. Good. Well,
how did you actually, if it was censored, how did you actually,
well, doesn't mean it's lost. In other words, just the print, most printed edition was censored. Even the old manuscript
still there. How are you?
Here.
This says it all.
Well, most of the society.
I need to devour the crowd.
Yeah, someone should ask me. I should know. Now, no, that's the source sheet. This is the cow. It's a good question. I don't know.
So the two examples that you gave, the gold where he shows the chakras, is that consistent with what he does?
Most of the time.
Slowly?
But what I tried to show is that he'll pull the chakras. He just sometimes doesn't like it. I shouldn't be like,
no,
there are times.
No, you don't take those.
But he'll always introduce it and say, this is the drop. Rashi will not do that. Rashi will just pull the drop as if it's, he'll blend the two. But Doc, when he mentioned it, very clear, I'm leaving the world a literal, or I'm going, because I, he says sometimes he'll say, I don't have a literal way of understanding this, I'm forced to use it for understanding this in the drop. Right, oh yeah.
Of course. I'm not a member of the seminar.
Okay, what's your name?
Max.
Nice to meet you. Hello, nice to meet you.
I first noticed part one when it was too late to join, so okay. I'm happy to see part two. Could I get caught up? Not video at all.
I'm pretty sure they have
part
all
part one? Just call the office?
Sure. Yeah.
When I asked the office, they told me to talk to you, so... Well, I'll take it up later, I just...
Email them and ask them to talk to me, and we'll get back to you with the...
Okay. So there is still, I mean, you can still get a copy of new edition of the Doc stuff, and you can see it in...
Of course.
I have...
No one was the miracle? Did anyone believe that happened?
Number one.
I'm a baby.
You know how it
is. That's what people keep asking. How do you listen? I don't have a good answer.
And the other one was really good.
No, I'm sorry.
I also want to know, when you give the father, son of so-and-so, if you ask the father about how he gets the writings, the son of his education. However, is there anything written about the mother? Nothing.
His father played a major role before him. I didn't even get into that. His father was actually almost more of a prolific writer than he was.
Really?
Yeah, Yosef Kimmel, he wrote all the same stuff. He wrote a number of works. If you go on the Hebrew books, you put his name down, it tells you something about him.
And his father, did his father have any anti-Christian bias in his writings?
Yes.
He did.
Yes.
So he set an example.
Yes, that's why I mentioned that, but again, as it was, it's time.
Didn't
have any. I could have.
You know, and I just start to back and tell us what you're doing. You're doing it. You're a great teacher. I wrote that to
you. And sometime during his life, that's when they had two popes going on at the same time, one another young, and Avignon was using a lot, and everything else. There was also, if you remember, a very famous, which went on for years, Christian, what they called the heresy, where they were anti-Trinitarian. It's possible maybe he was aligning himself one side as opposed to
I don't know, but that's...
Because otherwise, you know, it would have been a record.
How did you get away? That's why I think that he may have aligned himself in the anti-Trinitarian. I can look it up. I'll ask somebody who's following.
They just play as a
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.
That was very good.
Oh, I should have to